Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this special podcast for Black History Month. I just introduced myself. My name's Dave Brown, and I work for Pine Court Housing. I'm the director there, and I've been working there for the last 20 years. So this is, as I say, a special podcast just to celebrate Black History Month. We've got three people with us today who are prepared to share their experiences and their thoughts. The first guest is Alicia. Alicia, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Alicia Johnson and I'm an apprentice plasterer at Savini.
Brilliant. And Stephen?
Hi, my name is Stephen Lodigy. I'm an assistant investment manager at Savini Property Services.
Thanks, Stephen. And Jay?
Yeah, Jay Spear. I'm managing director at Amiantol Services.
Great. It's good to have you all with us. So I wanted to start off by looking at some of our personal journeys, really, some of our individual heritage. If I start with myself, I'm mixed race or dual heritage, I suppose. My grandfather on my dad's side was born in West Africa in Sierra Leone, and he married an English woman from Scotland Road. And my mum's both parents were Welsh. So that's my heritage from West Africa, but I'm Liverpool born and bred. I don't know who wants to go next and let us know about theirs. Say, Jay?
Yeah, Dave, I'm like yourself, Liverpool born and bred, as is me mum and dad. My dad's black and so is my mum. My dad's dad was from, he was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and my dad's mum was actually born in Liverpool, and obviously they met. My mum's dad, as I know him, as I call him my granddad, he's from a country, Guyana, which is in South America. And my mum's mum, she's white British from Liverpool.
That's Jack. Alicia?
So my great-grandfather is from Sierra Leone as well, West Africa. Now, my grandfather's mother, she was mixed race. I'm not 100% sure where her heritage came from, but we know she was half Norwegian. So she's, we think African, but we're not 100% sure on that.
Yeah.
And half Norwegian. And then my granddad, he was born in Liverpool. And he married my nan, and my nan was British born also. My nan was white, and my mother she's mixed, and then my dad's also white.
Right.
So quite mixed.
Yeah.
But yeah, originally it's Sierra Leone, West Africa, where we come from.
Lovely. And Steve?
Yeah, my heritage is quite unusual. You know, like Jay and Dave, I'm Liverpool born and bred. But my father was from Oyo State, Ibadan, and Nigeria. And, you know, that's his lineage from there. My mother is from an island called St. Vincent's, which is next door but one to St. Lucia, which is a holiday destination in the West Indies. She actually came over as part of the Windrush generation. And they met in the 70s on a 70s kid. It's an unusual mix, you know, it's like in the 70s to get Nigerian. And West Indian, like cultures blending,
yeah,
in order to create the lineage that I've got.
Yeah, that is. I mean, that is unusual in terms of us three sitting around the table with you here in terms of our influence from the white side of our families, really, isn't it? But you know, as I say, but all we've all got mixed heritages. So moving on from that, and again thinking about when we were younger, how did your family or the community that you grew up with? Or the media that we were exposed to as children, did that help us understand or celebrate our own history and culture? I mean, again, I'll start for me. My dad had several brothers and sisters, and they all married white women from Liverpool 8. So all my cousins looked like me. They all spoke like me. They were all Liverpool born and bred. So I just, you know, it was normal for me just to grow up in a mixed community. I grew up in Liverpool 8 for the first 4 or 5 years of my life. And then we moved out to Aintree with my dad's job. And then we moved back to Mossley Hill when I was about 13 or 14. So I grew up in a mixed environment in terms of diversity. Then went to an all-white area, if you like, in Aintree. And then we moved back to the south end of Liverpool. So for me, growing up, it was normal for me to see people of mixed race like myself and going back to the pool later, the community to see friends and family. So I kind of understood my culture from that view. And I'm not sure whether that's the same for anybody else. Alicia?
Yeah, I grew up in Wavertree, which is a very, very, very multicultural area. So like yourself, for me, you know, it was normal to see people different, you know, different colours and everything.
Did you have any kind of, did you think it was Black history or Black culture, or was it just normal to you?
Just normal to me, really, yeah. I feel like it's more when I've moved on to, like, going to college and stuff. That's where I learnt more about Black History Month as a month of celebration.
Yeah.
But generally, growing up, I've always been in a very multicultural environment.
Yeah.
And obviously, with my family, and were you saying like all your cousins and everything looked like it?
Yeah.
It's a bit different for me in that respect, because a lot of my cousins, so my granddad's siblings, they married other Black people.
Hell yeah.
My granddad was the only one who married a white lady.
Yeah.
So we were different, but not different, if that makes sense.
Just picking up on that. So if your cousins then were darker than you, shall we say, how did they accept you? How did that work in when you were growing up? Did they see a difference, or was it just, we're all family, but it doesn't matter what colour we are, what shade we are?
Yeah, no, there was never any difference. As early as I got older, I noticed myself, you know, just generally. I just noticed as I got older, but no, never seen as any difference or in any way.
Yeah.
And like women and granddad, they got married in 1954, which, as we know at the time, it wasn't as acceptable.
Of course.
Back then, I've got so much respect for my nan and granddad for not listening to what people said and, you know, just being in love and things like that.
I mean, my dad was born in the 1940s, so my nan and granddad got married in you know, just around the wartime, and, you know, probably went through similar experience. It just frowned upon, you know, walking down the street, people would be, you know, I mean, I it's only hearsay, but they'd be spat on and, you know, be cursed for, especially me nan being a white woman, being with a Black guy, an African guy, you know. I'm sure we've all got stories like that, and there's loads of history about back in the day how mixed race couples were treated and that kind of thing. But I'll bring in Jay now, just to talk about.
Yeah, you want to hear Mrs. Jay? My dad's just similar to you, dude. My dad was, you know, he's got, I think he's got five brothers and two sisters. They all grew up around Liverpool, as you did. And when he met my mum, I think both they lived around that area or just outside that area for a little bit, and then ended up moving down towards, you know, Gerrard Gardens, Gerrard Crescent, which was where I was born. So I pretty much grew up there, and then they knocked the flats down and they built some social housing there. But you could literally say that, like, you know, I feel my growing up, it was black and white, because where we lived and where I grew up, the only Black people that I used to see was family. But then my dad used to take me up to see my nan up around the village. She used to live in Carton Street, you know, Cavanna's on the corner there. And when we used to go up there, and my dad would take me to barbers on Granby Street. So we used to walk through, and you'd get all the sights, you'd get all the smells, you'd get all the everything to do with Black history and all that. And that was where I would get my sort of influence from. And obviously sitting around with my dad's brothers and whatnot, and just listening to them talking about things and people and their point of view and what's going on during the week and whatnot. So, and then again, we'd leave and we'd come back home, and it was like, you know, it was just strange, because there wasn't many Black people living around that area, like I say, at the time.
Yeah.
And it was for the sake of what? A mile and a half, as the crow flies. I found it like really, really strange.
Yeah, I think, like to say, back in those days, it was a little bit less inclusive than what it is now. And hopefully we're moving in the right direction. And with new communities moving in, you know, not just to Liverpool Lake, but in Liverpool in general, and then into the city region. Stephen, what was your kind of experiences?
No, it couldn't be a more stark contrast, I think. I grew up in L24, which is Speke, and we moved there around about the mid-70s. You know, there was our family. I had, you know, four siblings, two older brothers, two younger sisters. My nan and her then children, my aunties and uncle, moved down there. And ironically, another family called the Browns, which were down there as well.
We gotta be then.
You know, so, you know, I didn't really, unless it was family, didn't see many, you know, Black faces. My culture, my upbringing, not a culture, my upbringing was predominantly boys. All my neighbours were boys. You know, all my school friends were boys and kids in the local area. And again, like you, Jade, I was at the barbershop on Granby Street. And that was just like the highlight, you know, so say, because, you know, you go down there and yeah, you get the smells, you get the taste, you know. And, you know, say, because it was a completely different world, you know, to what I was actually experiencing as a child. You know, did it shape me or influence me? And I don't really think so. But I was aware that, you know, the white people were in one area and the black people were in another. And I did start to wonder why that was the case.
Just picking up on that then, Steve, in terms of you've actually got a different background to us three in terms of where you grew up. Did you have the schooling speak?
I did, yeah.
What was that like in terms of were there any other black families in the school? What was it like? Everyone going to school and speaking?
My auntie's uncle were a few years older than myself. Better came to secondary school, so they passed through. They went to speak community comprehensive, and they passed through. And it was just myself and the siblings who were there, and the barons. Other than that, you know, there were no other, you know, black kids there. So it's like, you know,
any black teachers?
There were no black teachers. I didn't know, and there were no any ethnic minority teachers of any other description.
Yeah,
and yeah, it was predominantly white. And this is an experience probably carried from primary school onwards to Alderwood Primary School.
Yeah.
And, you know, from what I can recall, it's the same there as well. It was just a predominantly white area and had been for quite some time.
So I'll bring Jay and Alicia in a minute. Just in terms of your school experience then, in terms of being black, being a minority, did you encounter any racism or what you thought was racism? I know we were only young and maybe it didn't resonate as racism at the time, but any incidents, or was it we just kind of accepted as you know, Steve?
For the most part, when in primary school, you know, acceptance was the case, because I don't think, you know, unless there's, you know, specific family circumstances, I don't think people are as aware of that age. However, when I got to secondary school, that did change quite significantly. I didn't used to walk home from school. I used to fight my way home from school.
Really?
You know, if I went by without a week without some sort of altercation, it was a good week, you know. It was a good week. And obviously you get a bit of a reputation. People, you know, sort of want to take you on, because if they take you down, then they're, you know, and that just became just like, you know, a way of life during the later part of my secondary school. Did I get into trouble for it? Yeah. Did I cause it sometimes? I probably did. You know, but it's an experience just from the colour of your skin someone shouldn't really have to go through.
Exactly. And I'll bring Jay and Alicia in at the moment, but it's funny, isn't it? Because I had a totally different experience to you. I was kind of accepted. I know I'm lighter skinned, and I'm not sure that makes a difference, but I never had any pressure in school whatsoever. I was quite a popular pupil. I had loads of mates, loads of white mates. Did you do any sports or anything like that at school? Because I think for me, I used to play a sport of football. I was quite good at football. And so that kind of made me more accept, you know, my mates accepted me, and it probably broke down some barriers that I didn't have to experience. Did you do any sports at all?
I just want to, you know, go back and clarify a point beforehand, though. It wasn't like that all the time.
No, I
wasn't everyone. Yeah, it was just certain individuals, you know, who just thought that kind of behavior was acceptable. For the most part, yeah, I was quite popular. I did have a lot of friends. Had I more friends, because track and field was my sport. Anything up to 400 meters, I was pretty good. Yeah, pretty much unbeatable. You know, in a lot of field events. And you know what? I really enjoyed that. But I decided that, you know, that wasn't the way I wanted to go.
Great. Alicia, what about you?
So my school experience, I went to secondary school. I went to Belle Reve, which is a Catholic all-girls school. and it's sort of borderland, except from Egbert, isn't it? So it was a very mixed group. I'd say about 50-50 probably. But I got expelled and I went to New Hayes, which is close to Speak, Garston. Now the school was very predominantly white. And I felt accepted right from the beginning, but then there was an incident which took place after school. It was actually on a weekend and it was in Garston Village. And I had this lad who was like known for being pretty, pretty tough. Like a couple of people did say to me, he's racist, but he'd come over to me and make conversation and we'd speak and, you know, everyone, you know, didn't see that at first. And then there was this incident where the things he said, obviously I can't repeat, they were absolutely disgusting. And I actually ended up punching him in the face and I broke his nose. So I feel like that was my first sort of experience of being, well, it wasn't my first experience being in that area, being in that school.
Yeah.
And I feel as though, again, I don't condone violence, but because of the way I handled the situation, everyone just took it as, well, don't mess with it. Don't mess with it. So I didn't have any trouble after that. And perception with me, like some people have said to me, oh, I can't tell you mixed. And, you know, some people can. It's quite a varied sort of perception of how people see me. But one thing I do remember, being in Garston on the weekends with my friends,
yeah,
I could never go under the bridge.
Yeah.
Back then, they used to say to me, no, Alicia, you can't go there. Yeah. But it's all changed. It has changed. The house, I've been knocked down. Yeah. It's different. Everything's a bit different there now.
I know
what's what happened at the time.
Yeah, it was like, I know we're talking about when we were younger, and you know, we must let things have changed for the better. Hopefully, we'll conclude that one way at the end. But things, we'll just talk about our early experiences. And you're right. I mean, Garston under the bridge was loads of no go areas.
Yeah.
You know, to a certain extent, Speak was a no go area. Yeah. And I'm saying no go area in, you know, in that sense. But understand.
I'd be with everyone. We'd be in the village and, you know, having a laugh too. Whatever. And then when it come to like, oh, we need to go, they'd be like, at least you can't. I'd have to like, but you know, people would stay, or I'd go home then, you know. It was just like, I literally would stand at the bridge and wouldn't go through it. But yeah, just with the way that situation was handled, again, not condoning it, but it kind of gave me like a, right, she's from Tochy. Everyone presumes they're from Tochy. She's from Tochy and she's dead hard. Just leave it. Don't mess with her type of thing, you know, like really kids, obviously. But yeah, so I experienced it, but it wasn't there. It didn't continue after that.
Yeah. And Jay, what's your experience?
Yeah, well, you're dead hard and you are from Tochy.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, for me, infants and juniors was pretty mundane, all white school, all white teachers, and in a warped kind of way, I kind of enjoyed my school experience. And you know, whether it was because I got into football and stuff during my junior years and played in a league where kids from all over, like sort of that, the sort of Liverpool 3 and surrounding areas, Anfield and Walton and all them, they were all playing in the same league. So
yeah,
when I went to senior school, I was probably bumping into, I went with a load of mates, don't get me wrong, and my mates from back in the day from junior school, when we moved to senior school, they've all been, they're still mates today, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it was only when we got to senior school that probably, I wouldn't say the trouble start, but you kind of get people thinking that they can take liberties. But, you know, I was brought up, you know, don't take any nonsense.
Yeah.
So it got dealt with as soon as it cropped up, it got dealt with. Did they get in trouble for it? No, because you'd get pulled to one side and it'd be like, what's going on there? And I'd say, he said this. And then the teacher would just go, pfft,
sounds.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was the way, and there was no black teachers
in
my senior school either. In terms of black kids, I can't remember one when I joined the senior school. And then the year below me, or when I was in second year, the first year, there was one that came in the following year.
Yeah.
But in the main, I would say there was probably a handful of black kids that come through our senior school before I left.
Yeah.
But like I say, because I was playing football and stuff, and people got to know my face and got to know who I was, and you're playing against kids, and then you're coming, and then they're in the same team as you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty that you know, it wasn't a scene out of Warriors like Steve's. Yeah, Steve's has been, but you know, obviously you got the odd one or two who thought that they could take the prevail and obviously got shown that they couldn't.
I mean, just thinking back from what I first said, I didn't have any trouble in school, but I remember I had like a close group of five or six mates, all white, and we all used to go to Calderstones Park. I went to Quarry Bank, which is Calderstones. And I recall we'd been playing football in the park and we were on our way home. It was like a Sunday afternoon, you know, in the autumn. Anyway, a police van come past and the next thing just stopped and all the officers just jumped out the van and got us all up against the wall and kind of said, "Who's just spat at the van?" And we're like, "No one." I mean, no one of you has just spat at the van. And I kind of got separated. So we fired white mates on one side, one end of the wall, and I got some policeman said to me, "Come over here, you." So, and then he says to me, "What are you doing round here?" I went, "I'm with me mates." He went, "No, but what are you doing round here?" I said, "What do you mean round here? You know, you're not from round here. Get back to where you live." I said, "Well, I do live round here. I live with all my mates in Mossley Hill, and that's my school there." And he went, "Don't be giving me lip." He said, "Do you want to go in the back of the van?" I went, "No, of course not." He said, "Well, effing well, get on." I said, "That's where we were going." He went, "I'm going to put you in the van in a minute." So it's just like an experience growing up. Although I'm not going to talk about police pressure now, and I don't really want to go down that road. But it's similar to what you were saying in terms of having, you know, different experiences of growing up with from your education side, being a teenager. I wanted to ask you, I probably asked Stephen, you said there was no black teachers in your school.
No, no.
Alicia, were any in yours?
No.
And no juniors or senior school?
No, neither.
So we did have one black teacher in our school, and he was quite influential for me, because he must have been that much older, although might be doing him a bit of a disservice. So I don't know whether you've heard of the group called the Christians.
Yeah.
So they... older brother, Victor Christian, he wasn't ever a member of the group, but he was a musician. He was a music teacher in school, but he also did like a pastoral role and did a bit of sport. And he was just fantastic for me. And there was a few black kids in the school and some Chinese kids, and he had kind of a rapport with them, and he didn't teach us. I never taught music. I can't play a note, can't hold a tune, but he used to go out of his way and look after. So I suppose when you think about my school days, I'd see him as a role model, if you like. And I wanted to ask you before we moved on to kind of, you know, our professional careers, during your school lives and growing up as teenagers, did you have any role models or anyone that stands out to you as a young person before you became an adult and then started on your own journey?
Well, I used to perform in hip hop. Yeah. It was a lot when I was younger, MCing, beat rapping, if you want to call it. And I feel like I had quite a few people, quite a lot of inspiration from. There's a girl, I'm still in contact with her now, Nikki Blaze. She's a performer. She does a lot with the youths herself. And there was a guy named James Class. He's actually passed away. When I was growing up, like, he was always in the music scene and everything. So yeah, I'd say like they were a big influence for me back then, when I was very much involved with like the Liverpool hip hop scene. If you like, I'd say that both of them were two very big influences on me.
Lovely. Steve?
I didn't really have much in the way of role models from an external influence. I'd say probably my role models were my parents, tell you the truth.
Yeah.
You know, they just were who they were. You know, they lived life the best they could, and they were just unapologetic for what they are, despite other people's perceptions. And I think for me, just them being, I hate this expression, true to themselves, you know, had a big influence on me on the way that I wanted to live. You know, I didn't want to live to apologize. Oh, I'm sorry that, you know, if I made you feel comfortable because of, but, you know, they were my role models.
Yeah. I'll bring Jay in now. And maybe I should say this. One of the biggest role models was my father, and he's quite well known in the Liverpool community, Wally Brown. Obviously being involved in social politics, anti-racism work since the 1980s, his involvement in the riots. So again, I talked about being brought up amongst my cousins and my uncles, but I've always known since I was younger about what racism was and how you needed to rise up and speak up and fight against it and try and make change and you know, through my dad, really. So thanks for it, reminds me of that. I don't think I would have got away without mentioning him there.
And Jay? Yeah, it goes without saying, obviously, my parents just to, you know, drill that into me that you are who you are and, you know, you don't change. Regardless of, you know, what you come up against, you, like you say, you've got to be who you are. But kind of growing up when I left school and started playing football and stuff, it was probably when I joined Everton. There was a couple of black players who joined the club, and there wasn't many when I joined.
Yeah.
But they started to sign the likes of Earl Barrett and Daniel Amakachi and people like that. And, you know, just seeing them, watching them go about the day-to-day business and being who they are on the pitch, and obviously sometimes hearing what they had to put up in on the pitch,
yeah,
and still performing the way they did was quite inspirational. But there was one fella who wasn't black or from that kind of background who taught me even more, and that was like Neville Southall, and he's quite outspoken for equality.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you follow his Twitter accounts, he's always for the gay community as well as racial. But yeah, he kind of taught me in a way that, you know, people are who they are, and in a crowd of 40,000 people, you're going to get your fair share of racial idiots. Do you know what I mean? Now, people seem to think that they pay the money, they can say what they want, and especially back a few years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, that was true. But, you know, there's been a lot of work now towards the stamp it out, I'll break it out type campaign.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, unless there's some kind of actual deterrent for people, then again, people are going to think that they can pay the 70, 80 quid and scream and say what they want.
Yeah. No, I understand. Right. Okay. I think we're about halfway through. I wanted to change tack a little bit and started to ask you your thoughts around your profession, if that's okay, and where you are at the moment, how you got there. I suppose, Alicia, I'll come to you first. You're currently an apprentice.
I am.
Plasterer.
Yeah.
Is that what you wanted to be when you left school?
I've wanted to be many, many things. I have. We need more time for me to go through all my like career ideas and things that I've done and I've gone for. But plastering for me, it's been my interest in construction and buildings as a whole, really. That's sort of brought me to here. I actually done bricklaying first in college and then tried to get an apprenticeship in that. I wasn't successful. So then I went on to do plastering because I thought, well, I like that too.
Yeah.
So I went, and very luckily, as I got to the end of the course, I got this job.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I haven't had, as far as I know, any obstacles or anything. I think, and not to do with, obviously, with the company, but I think construction industry as a whole, the more interesting the fact that I'm a woman rather than me colour or me religion or, you know, anything like that. But even with that being said, I wouldn't say career-wise I've faced any obstacles that I'm aware of.
What did you do, like, when you first left school? Were you working then? What type of stuff did you do before you got into construction?
So when I first left school, I was working there before I left school. I was working in hairdressers, washing hair, and I literally just done it for the money. People used to say, oh, you want to be a hairdresser? And no, for this. Was doing it for the money.
So you can get the weekend or something.
That's it, yeah. And then I went on to do, actually got my taxi license out with 21, yeah. And then I only done it for 3 weeks and then went, that's not for me, this.
Yeah.
But I continued to renew my license and years later I did go back to it. I sort of settled once I realised taxis weren't for me at that time. I sort of settled on security. I worked at the Echo Arena.
Okay.
Doing like the events and sometimes just doing like the day-to-day security, or there was an event on. And then I worked in the job centre as well doing security. I was only like 22 when I started there as well. I mean, that's not even
touching it.
Tip of the iceberg.
You're settled now and you're supported.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, very much so. I haven't had any sort of
sorts of issues where I've felt like, you know, I've been singled out in any way.
No, that's not, you know, that's positive.
And that's from, you know, from all aspects of myself, like, you know.
Yeah. All right, so I'll come back to Jane and I'll bring Stephen in. So you mentioned Everton before, so were you ever, you were a professional footballer?
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about that? And then how come you're now working with asbestos?
Yeah, so I went there straight from school. So I knew what I was doing. Well, I knew what I was going to be doing sort of part way through my final year in school. I spent from the ages of 16 to the ages of about 23. I think I was playing full time. I left Devon and then went to a couple of clubs, played full time. Come out of the full time game, stayed playing part time, and then went through a range of jobs that you'd like. A bit like Alicia, you really believe everything from personal training to sales and everything else in between. I was working for Barclays at the time and I got offered to go back into the full-time game, which I did. Spent another 2 years in the full-time game player coaching, and then got made, the club that I was at got put into administration. So I lost my job and a few others lost my job.
Yes.
And at the time, my brother-in-law had his own asbestos firm.
Okay.
So we just said, come work for me while you're looking for something.
Yeah.
Because it was literally like kind of towards the end of the season. So I knew that there was going to be a period of time where I'd have opportunity, but I wouldn't be working, if that makes sense. And then I find myself still working for them 16 years later. So that was supposed to be a stopgap, or it just ended up being a permanent thing. And how did they end up here? I got the opportunity to come work for the construction division,
yeah,
which I took.
Yeah.
And then 12 months after that, the opportunity came up to take over Amiens. So it was on an interim basis to begin with.
Yeah.
And I'm still here now.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So how I got into asbestos was a complete freak. It was probably because I was not lost my job. Well, yeah, lost my job and come out of the full-time game, but I've still played part-time and
yeah.
I'm work. But like I say, I've had an array of jobs from personal trainer to salesman to, I once sold Hoovers, believe it or not. I'll go back in my car, can you believe? Chasing up and down Liverpool.
Can't believe it, yes, LNE.
He's Hoovers, I'll go back in my car. And I got a cupboard actually because I went down to my mum's to show her what I was doing and all that. And I went through the full demonstration. So I said to her, do you want one? She went, no, and I got a big cupboard. Stump. Oh, deal.
Okay, thanks for that, Jace. Stephen, what if I got your, I know we've spoken in the past, and I do know a little bit about your previous jobs, but, you know, share it with the rest of the audience.
Didn't really know what I wanted to do. My dad gave me an interest in photography, which, you know, I still have and I still love. I was adamant, I think, you know, about my career path was going to be fashion photographer in Milan. That was it. Yeah, that's all I wanted to do. Anyways, didn't transpire that way. And I think the first job was like working in a warehouse, just doing order picking. And then if anyone out there still remembers Quicksave, yeah, so it's like, you know, the shelf stacking Quicksave for a good couple of years. I was just unsettled, but I knew that, you know, I could do things and I could progress in that. So I retrained to do office work, and then so it's like then, you know, I had quite a lengthy spell doing customer service jobs in contact centres and things like that. I remember going for an interview once at Dixon's in town on Lord Street, and I genuinely don't know why this guy was surprised, you know, because on my application form, there's Stephen Ladgy, not your typical surname, gets round the door, so saying, and then this guy's got a beaming face and then just takes one look at me and his smile just drops. And then there was a kind of a false smile, you know, because it was kind of like shock look on his face. I go, he's black. It's on my face that I can see he's black. I'd better put my smile back on. And from that point on, and that interview, I mean, I knew I wasn't probably going to get the job, which I subsequently didn't, you know, but I was aware of how other people, so to say, still have that perception and don't know how to deal, you know, with a black person.
Yeah.
Take the black off. You're just a person.
Yeah.
They're just a person, you know. I think that kind of like then forced me into the call center work simply because I didn't have to
be face to face anymore. Well, I was on the phone, you know, and that was just kind of like an easy choice. But there's only so many call center jobs you can do, whether you're in the job center or you work in insurance, you know, or you're selling holidays, which I've done all of. And then that's when I kind of like started to, again, look towards retraining.
Yeah.
There wasn't much out there in the way of help. So a lot of the training, external training courses that I've done, I've undertaken, you know, and paid for myself.
Yeah. And then landed in housing. It was when I was doing call centre work that actually, you know, ended up in housing.
I was working in housing. I did a CIH 2 and CIH 3. I was working in housing. And when the government did the U-turn, and now all the business had to redo their business plan, I think that was around about 2014, 2015. Unfortunately, the contract at the time was temporary, ongoing.
Yeah.
And it didn't get renewed. But again, I just had this, you know, I just wanted that, you know, I had this drive.
Yeah.
So, when we first met, actually,
yeah.
I was bus driving.
Yeah,
well, I actually came for the interview.
Thank you for an interview, yeah.
That's it. You were for Pine Call for an NSO.
You did.
And that's when we first met. It was such a great interview. And I went back, you know, and I was telling my wife, and I was just like, oh, yeah, it's a really good interview. You know? And then, I was unsuccessful, unfortunately, but I was like, yeah, I think I want this company.
Is it overkin?
Yeah. So I just kept on trying, went for another NSO interview, and I didn't get that. And then subsequently landed the role over, it was a tenant liaison officer for SBS, and I think it was Savini's 10th birthday bash.
Yeah,
and I surprised the hell out of you. Yeah, just didn't expect to see you.
Although I did get asked about you, and you might not know this, I did put your name forward. I said we've interviewed someone there, and if we had two jobs, and I would have given them another job, but I haven't got two jobs. But you need to, you know, if there's anything coming up, he's a good lad, if you know what I mean.
No, I'm very grateful for that. But yeah, you know, so yeah, I met you again at the 10th birthday bash, and that was good.
Yeah.
And the support that I've had actually whilst I've been at Savini, you know, it's just been good, because really great, because pretty much everything I've asked for, I've got. Yeah. It's like I've been able in the 3 and odd years that I've been here to move from a TLO to an assistant manager. I'm on the right track. The progression is there, being supported through that progression, and people are looking at me, you know, not looking at sort of like, you know, where's he from, you know, what we call him, skin, looking at me as an individual. And I think that's just like,
it's refreshing, isn't it?
It's a close refreshing, yeah, yeah.
So I've got a totally different career path than you three. I left school at 17, and my first job was working for the city council in a housing office. And I've been in housing ever since. 40 years, different associations, different councils, different jobs, but nothing like your varied careers, just housing, dealing with communities. So it's weird, isn't it, that we're all sitting around the same table, working for the same organisation, but we've all had different paths to get here.
Yeah.
And I think what we're all saying is, our current roles, we all feel supported, we all feel as if race isn't an issue for us at this stage in our lives. And I wanted to bring us back to the whole concept of Black History Month and ask a final couple of questions, really, in terms of how you personally view Black History Month. Is it a time for reflection? Is it a time for celebration? Is it a time for education? Is it a learning opportunity for others, or is it more than that? Stephen, do you want?
Yeah.
What does it mean to you? And to, you know,
do you know what my first exposure to it probably, and I know it's been in October, is the Notting Hill Carnival.
Yeah.
I mean, whenever that used to be on, it used to be like televised, I think, on BBC Two or something, and it was quite a big event. And then that's when the Black culture, it kind of hit me that this is something that we should be celebrating. Yeah. I think it's probably more about education,
yeah,
and acceptance.
Yeah.
If we can just get out there, you know, that we have a different background, it doesn't necessarily impact on anyone else. And at the end of the day, we're all just human beings. And if we can all sort of like live with that and accept that, then that's the way forward. I mean,
well, you nearly took the words out of my mouth. I've got a quote that I'm going to use to close the podcast. And it's very similar to what you just said. But before we get there, I'll bring in Alicia and what, you know, in terms of your thoughts around Black History Month, is it more of a celebration for you? Is it reflection? Is it a learning opportunity for others to learn about, you know, Black history, if you like?
Yeah, I think it's a celebration and also, yeah, an opportunity to educate. I agree with everything that Stephen said then as well. I think it's important for people to be able to celebrate the culture. But I also think it's important for other people from other cultures or from different backgrounds to then be educated and celebrate. And yeah, I think it's very important.
Yeah.
And it is something that I think everyone should get involved in and be a part of it and just enjoy the culture and everything. Yeah.
Enjoy.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Definitely a celebration of the big names that we hear about quite often, but also, like you say, an education of those who have made a difference, but you don't hear about those who aren't on the telly every 5 minutes and those who aren't making movies or you know, being given awards and whatnot. You know, there's thousands of people, just general people who make a difference and in the community, for a positive difference in the community that go unnoticed. So for me, it's just a shame that it's just a month and it's not a couple of days each month or a week each month, because I think it would justify it. In terms of kind of learning opportunities and whatnot, then just going back to school, like you said, David, it wasn't promoted in the curriculum or anywhere. It was history was the war.
Yeah.
Geography was, you know, you learn about the different countries, but you don't learn about these African countries or these South American countries and what they do and what they export and what they import and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
It was just World War One, World War Two in history.
Yeah.
And that was it. I don't know what it's like in school these days. It might be a lot different. But yeah, I agree with Alicia and Steve.
Brilliant. Okay. Just got a couple of more questions I've got for us before we finish. Just in terms of, we've talked about allies earlier on in the podcast, didn't we? We talked about our friends and family who may not be black. How do you think our allies can support ethnic minorities, communities more effectively and respectfully? And is that important for us as black people? Stephen?
I've had an ally by my side the last 29 years. You know, my wife. My wife didn't see me as black. She just saw me as me. And I think if people, so say in general, are on that basis, they could just treat each other as human beings and with respect. And you're not going to get perfect every time. But, you know, if you try, then that's the most important thing.
Okay. Just one more question for us all, I think. We're trying to develop a race equality group within Savini, aren't we, in the workplace? I suppose the question, and I'm keen to kind of lead on this and get people involved, but do you think it can make a difference? And if so, how do we attract and recruit and retain a more diverse workforce going forward? I mean, Jay, have you got any thoughts around that? Would you support the notion of a race equality group to look at our practices and procedures and see how we can better recruit going forward and develop our own staff?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got to be honest, it wasn't a problem for me, and there was never any, I've never felt like I've had to be more than what I've been working for the other group.
Yeah.
So I, in that score, I think, you know, fair play to what's already in place. But anybody who's got an interest in black history or ethnic and, you know, backgrounds and whatnot, or learning more about it, you know, by all means, get involved. It goes back further than what people actually realise, black history. You know, I thought it was introduced in the 80s, Black History Month, but apparently it goes back to the 20s, which I only realized not so long ago. So, you know, if you've got a passion or even just an interest and you want to get involved, I'd say get involved.
Okay. So, last question. If any of the listeners can take one thing away from our stories or our journeys today, what do you hope that it is? What do you hope it is, Jay?
We've spoken a lot about negative experiences, but I've got to say, when growing up and where I used to live, we all had each other's backs. Do you know what I mean? I can honestly say that, you know, people, it wasn't a racist community that we grew up. It was just like a there wasn't very many black people in there.
Yeah.
And then obviously, you know, When you used to go down to the likes of LA, there wasn't very many white people
there.
Do you know what I mean? So, not all people are bad.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, and you know, I can honestly count on two fingers the number of people I've physically cut out and stopped contacting because of their views and stuff. So that's all I'd say there.
Alicia, have you got any thoughts about, you know, what, just one thing that you'd like listeners to take away from what we've been talking about today?
It is a minority than a majority that we've had these type of experiences. A lot of things have been positive, and I think, again, it's also in this day and age, obviously things still go on, but people are a lot more accepting and educated.
Yeah.
Without sounding cheesy, but we're all one race, the human race type of thing, and that's, you know, we're all as one basically. Yeah. You know, and different backgrounds, different experiences, but you know, but we can all come together and just be humans.
Stephen, I know you've. I'll give you one last chance. Go on before I come in.
I'm going to get philosophical here. I'd just say, you know, people, if you are aware of conscious and unconscious bias and what they are, just examine your own unconscious bias, because it's, you'll learn things about yourself, but by examining that, you'll also learn things about other people as well. Yeah, and it might not be how you first perceived a person, an individual, or a culture, or a race. Be honest with yourself. If there are changes that you need to make, then try and, you know, make those changes, because they, you know, any kind of change usually leads to an improvement. So if you can examine your conscious bias, you know, look towards self-improvement, it's just going to be for the betterment of yourself and for everyone that you interact with.
Yeah. Wow. Well said. Yeah. Can I leave you with this this quote then for Black History Month, which I had a little look last night, and there's dozens I could have chose, to be honest. And I think it echoes what we've all been saying. And it's this, and it's by Desmond Tutu, who was previously the Bishop of South Africa. And he says this: "My humanity is bound up in yours, for we can only be human together." So thanks for listening, and we hope you have a great week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.